Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. And on today's show, I sit down once again with Zarina Kanji, who is now WPIC's newly appointed Managing Director for the UK and Europe. Zarina shares insights into her career, the evolving e-commerce landscape in China, and the promising opportunities for UK and European brands in APAC markets. Our conversation begins with Zarina recounting her career journey, including her lengthy stint at Alibaba, detailing the experiences that shaped her expertise in Asian e-commerce, and her strategic vision for WPIC's expansion in the UK and Europe. She discusses the motivations behind her decision to join WPIC and what her appointment signifies for the company's global strategy moving forward. Zarina provides an in-depth analysis of how China's e-commerce landscape has transformed over the years and offers actionable strategies that brands can adopt to thrive in this dynamic market. She highlights the consumer sectors that hold the most promise for UK and European brands, emphasizing the lifestyle and economic changes that are driving these opportunities. The discussion also touches on the reasons behind the success of British brands in China, exploring cultural appeal and market strategies that resonate with Chinese consumers. Zarina's insights extend beyond China as she reflects on her experiences in Southeast Asia and shares her optimism about the e-commerce potential in other APAC markets. This broader perspective influenced her decision to join WPIC and shapes her approach to navigating the challenges and opportunities in these regions. Enjoy.
That's not something that consumers in the West are able to do. So, but they will be eventually. And all of these trends, they come from China and from Asia. So that's what makes that part of the world, you know, ever evolving, never changing. But also the consumers driving it. The consumers ever more demanding as well. And the brands want to be involved in that. And the platforms really facilitate that. So I think, you know, that is the most exciting thing, that it is, it's the leader in e-commerce. It's changing fast. But those changes, you never know what's coming next.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Zarina, welcome back to The Negotiation Podcast.
Hi, Todd. Thanks so much. It's great to be back on The Negotiation and to be part of the WPIC team.
Right? This is a cool happening that's going on. This is, I didn't see this coming. They kind of told me, I knew I would be interviewing you again. And I remember a lot of our last episode and recording. And then, you know, I start diving into what we're going to be talking about and like, oh my gosh, joining the team. This is amazing. What a grab by WPIC. Let's start by having you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory that led you up to this point.
Okay. Well, for the past decade, I have worked in the world of Asian e-commerce. So it's nicely aligned to what WPIC do. So I've been working with marketplaces, taking international brands to sell to consumers in both China and in Southeast Asia with the Alibaba Group. So I worked Southeast Asia at Lazada, and then I worked for Tmall Global, taking brands to China. So very parallel paths. The decade before that, I was in fashion buying. So I've always worked either with a brand, for a brand, always been in the brands world, love brands. So I just, after a decade at Alibaba, wanted to do something a little bit different, but obviously still use my existing experience. So when the opportunity to join WPIC came up, it made a lot of sense because it combined half of what I've done before, and also enables me to learn lots of new things as well, because we can work with every platform and marketplace across APAC. I'm adding on new geographies of South Korea and Japan, which, having, you know, spoken to lots and lots of brands over the years, all of those countries are interesting to them. So to be able to be part of a business that is basically the internet in Asia is really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So some of my questions that I wanted to follow up on, I think you dove into a little bit, but let me formally kind of ask them, and then you can add to some of the things that you just said, or maybe color in between, fill in between the lines a little bit. I wanted to ask, you know, what made you personally want to join WPIC? And you can tell the story of how you actually came to join WPIC. And then after that, let's dovetail that right into what your appointment signals for WPIC's ever-evolving strategy.
So I think, you know, first and foremost, one of the appealing things about working with WPIC is the opportunity to work, again, with great people. I've known some of the team at WPIC for maybe 4 or 5 years, having worked with them at my time at Alibaba. So I've always enjoyed working with you and with the wider team who I've met. So that's number one, because at the end of the day, what we're doing is not heart surgery. It should be enjoyable. So working with great people makes it fun, but also means that at the end of the day, you're generally doing a better job if you're happy doing what you're doing. So that was really important, that great people continue to be part of my career journey. And then I think, you know, the opportunity to just expand my knowledge, to deepen into other markets, but also to bring everything that I've got so far to WPIC from this European region. Because I guess for most of the listeners of the negotiation, they're aware that WPIC is a Canadian business, and they've never had feet on the ground in Europe. And it's something that Joseph, my manager, the co-founder, had said to me that, you know, he'd wanted to do, and sort of COVID put a bit of a delay on it. But now with me being here, they've got feet on the ground on British soil, able to really quickly get about Europe and to connect with the businesses that we already have here, but also to, you know, connect with all the trade organizations and the network, the industry network that's here, that I already have, that I can then also build on, and, you know, just really be someone that is accessible and helpful to everyone here, and to grow the opportunity for brands and businesses and organizations who are in Europe who want to get out to Asia and to do business and to reach Asian consumers.
It's interesting. I will say that the company, as far as I remember, was started by Jake in Beijing. And that is where the most thing I would say it's, to me, it's more of a China company than a Canadian company. Certainly a vast majority of the operations are in China, and a vast majority of the team are Chinese citizens. And then, of course, now opened up in Australia and expanding basically all through Southeast Asia. They have the, you know, Tokyo office and the Seoul office. And I don't know how they manage it all, honestly. So that's it's an incredible job that they're doing. Let's dive into a little bit of, you know, what you already know a lot about, and talk specifically about China's e-commerce landscape. How has it changed since you first entered the industry?
Oh, Todd, it's changing every day. You've been there as well. We've seen so many changes. I think, you know, it's become more dynamic. It's become more competitive. It's become more multifaceted. There are more channels than ever before. We've got a complete maturing of the original customers. You know, if you go back to when WPIC was founded, when Alibaba was founded, we're talking over 20 years ago. So those consumers who were 18 and first being able to make a transaction online back then, they're now fully grown adults with families, children, pets. They're looking after their parents as well. You've got this very multi-generational consumer now, who's completely native to e-commerce and digital, whereas they were all figuring it out at the start. So then you have their kids who are now shopping as well. So it's very everyday now, which I guess 10 years ago, it wasn't as everyday. And it's become, you know, really somewhere where I think, you know, Chinese e-commerce is the absolute leader. It is where all of the trends start. It's where everything exciting happens. And you notice that slowly expanding internationally. You know, when I was at Lazada, I worked in, I lived and worked in Singapore. And it was really the Chinese e-commerce habits, gamification, live streaming that were being adopted in Southeast Asia. It wasn't that more two-dimensional shopping format that we had at that time in the West that was being adopted. So you would look at a web page in China or in Asia, an app page as it is now, and it would be busy, it would be colorful, there'd be banners coming at you. And as a Westerner, you would think, gosh, this is crazy. But actually, an Asian consumer, a Chinese consumer really loves that. They immerse in that. That's what makes shopping online fun. That's what makes discovery fun. That's what makes you able to share things with your friends. And the way that the tech has really now evolved has made that ever more exciting. You know, if we were shopping on Tmall, for example, now, say we were both shopping for new pairs of sneakers, I could take a photo of myself trying on, digitally trying on the new pair of Nikes and send it to you in my avatar version and then get your opinion on what I was shopping. And that's not something that consumers in the West are able to do. So, but they will be eventually. And all of these trends, they come from China and from Asia. So that's what makes that part of the world, you know, ever evolving and ever changing. But also the consumers driving it, the consumers ever more demanding as well. And the brands want to be involved in that. And the platforms really facilitate that. So I think, you know, that is the most exciting thing, that it is, it's the leader in e-commerce. It's changing fast. But those changes, you never know what's coming next. You have to just really be involved and come up with it, because they're making shopping more fun. They're making e-commerce more fun all the time.
As you mentioned, some of these things are not available in the West. So they are not something that consumers use or are used to because it doesn't exist. But that also impacts the strategies and tactics around, you know, marketing and sales and even logistics that brands are used to using. So now, looking at their strategies and tactics for that area of the world, they have to be a lot different. And there's a learning curve involved. And there is new talents and skills and even education that need to be brought into the team in order to be successful in that world. Can you talk a little bit about some of the changes and adoption of new strategies and tactics that brands would need to capitalize on those differences and changes in that area of the world?
I think because most international brands have not done it before and they're not doing it every day from their Western head offices, there is a massive amount of test and learn that has to be done by those brands when they're working in China and in Asia. The only way to really find out what works for your brand is to try it and then take the data and analyze it and see where they pivot to next. So I think they need to be very open-minded in doing that. However, when the brands that do go to China and Asia and they do try it and they do learn, they have all of those lessons. So once those technologies become commonplace in the more Western platforms, it's native to them because they've done it before, they've tried it, they've understood, you know, a bit about how consumers react to that type of tech, whether that's AI photos or whether it's augmented reality experiences. They know, they've got some learnings, and then they can really easily adapt it. So being a pioneer out in China and in Asia really helps the global business for the brand. So I think that that's kind of one of the key strategies, just test and learn, not be too rigid.
But how open and amiable are Western brands, you know, Europe and North America, to the ideology that almost goes like, we're going to go into China, we're going to lose a ton of money, but we have to do it if we want to take the chance of making a ton of money? To me, this sounds like they're like, no, well, we have all our data and we have our gut instinct and we've got the team that was educated at Oxford or, you know, Yale, and we'll just lean on what they tell us to do, and it should work. We don't need to go and lose a bunch of money. That, to me, is kind of the way that that's the modus operandi that they've had for so many years, if not decades, to be successful and gotten to where they are. Do you find that there is resistance, or am I just completely wrong and they have a wildly huge appetite for the fail fast and fail huge in order to be successful?
I think in my experience, the brands that I've worked with, they've all been really excited about the opportunities in China and in Asia.
I want to jump in on that. Are these brands that are coming to you because they're interested in going, meaning the spark, the idea, the interest has already been there? Or are these brands that maybe you've approached and said, hey, you should think about going, and then here's all these things that you need to actually change about the way your approach and philosophy going into a new market, and they're actually still open to it?
It's a combination. You know, sometimes brands approach me and they've looked at the big numbers. You know, they've seen, say, population in China is X and this particular subcategory that I operate in is really growing. Therefore, I see it as a global strategy for me to be able to take the brand to China. Or it's, they happen to be at an event, we meet, I throw them some info about China and they go, oh, actually, we hadn't thought about that. You know, we were thinking about doing the US and we thought it was easy, but actually, our brand really appeals to young consumers. And when I look at the growing number of young people in China, actually, that would really resonate with my consumer. Have you got some data that I could examine and have a look at that I could then, you know, see where the fit would be? And then they get excited about it. So there's, I think it's a combination of both, really.
Do you find yourselves having to give good people unfortunate news? I feel like it's that scene out of the Matrix when the Oracle had to tell Neo that he was not the one. And she said, you know, I hate giving good people bad news.
Before that, have you sat together, brand and the partner? Have you gone through what the plan is for that campaign? Have you really looked at the detail on the pricing, on the products? Have you got enough stock in? Are you putting your marketing messages out at the right opportunity? You know, do you all agree on that? Are you all holding hands? And then if you are and it's bad, you know that you've prepared and you've put everything in place and you've talked about it. So you can then learn from it and you can then analyze it and grow and move forward. If you leave it all to the partner, say, and you've not been involved, then it's kind of, you know, bad things happen. It becomes a worse situation. So I think like constant communication, being active, not passive, and really kind of getting clear and working in partnership are the best ways to avoid, you know, negative moments.
It's just not every brand, not every product, not every sector is good for China, is good for expansion into China. So that kind of leads into my next question is talking about and asking you what consumer sectors in China do you think are most promising, particularly for UK European brands, which you are now in charge of. And please explain any of the lifestyle or economic changes that are driving these growth opportunities for those sectors that are promising.
I think the first two big ones are health and beauty. Chinese consumers, it's in their blood, it's in their DNA that health is wealth. And traditional Chinese medicine has been something that they have focused on for thousands and thousands of years, as well as looking after their skincare and their beauty. So those are still two really, really big areas. Obviously, COVID has driven the awareness on health. There's a government campaign, Healthy China 2030, that wants them, you know, the country to be living longer and living healthier, living better. So they are very much into those product areas. I think with beauty, personal care, health as well, the products are kind of lower price point. It's more accessible. You're not shelling out £2,000 for a pack of 30 days of supplements. You're shelling out like a smaller amount of money that becomes manageable. So it becomes appealing to a wider sector of the consumer base. So that's really great. You know how they always talk about the lipstick effect, you know, when the economy is bad, people start buying more lipstick because it's an affordable way to feel good and you can still buy it. So I think all of those things are still big, big categories and will continue to grow. And then you can get quite niche within it. So if you say take health supplements, is obviously super broad. There are so many out there, but let's think about what format it is. Is it an effervescent tablet? Is it a gummy? And then is it one of those products focused in on, say, mushrooms, or is it focused on magnesium? Like, you can get quite niche and then focus in on your customers. The other really big area still is mother and baby products. Basically anything you're putting on your skin or inside your body. Like, they really want to have really innovative, science-backed, efficacious products. And then for their little fairy friends, pets is a very big opportunity still. It's not always the easiest category to take into China. You know, the Chinese have lots of, rightly so, lots of regulations to ensure that the products coming in are the best quality. But the opportunity is growing so fast because Chinese consumers are growing to really love pets, and they're sort of delaying children having pets. So that, again, can get quite niche. It's not simply pet food or pet supplements. It's pet toys. It's pet accessories. It's tech within pet as well. So there's a huge opportunity for all of those things. It's a very, very interesting world.
I think there's a question that's interesting. It's an underlying, what do Chinese nationals believe that China does well? Therefore, it makes it more competitive for international brands to get into the market and be successful, versus what Chinese nationals maybe tend to believe they are not good at, which then makes the path a little bit easier for international brands to get into the market and be competitive. And I think about things like baby milk powder. It wasn't necessarily trusted to be made in China, so they loved the international brands because they just felt that they were a higher quality. And so it's sometimes, and I'm, I don't know if I'm looking to prove or disprove, but marrying the ideas of what they believe in as far as their homegrown products and sectors, and whether they trust, don't trust, have loyalty, not loyal, these kinds of things, and their own belief systems, and how that factors into the success for foreign brands in certain sectors versus others.
I think there's less stigma on where something is made. You know, like when I started my career, I worked in fashion, and there used to be some customers who would see a product, it was a premium brand, who would see a product and say, oh, this is made in China, I don't want that. But actually, China had some of the best technology in order to create this particular garment. You know, it had great embroidery machine toolings that you just couldn't produce in any other part of the world. So the advent of the internet, social media, you know, being able to showcase how a product is made and why it's made that way, and the, you know, the work that goes into it, means that there is less stigma around, oh, it's made in a certain country, like, I don't want to buy it from that country, to actually, that's really impressive that that country has that technology and they can do it, and that's what's made this garment that I couldn't find anywhere else in the world. So I think that's less of an issue now. It's more about what the end result is. I think where that becomes challenging is a brand can't say, hey, I'm a Spanish brand and I'm from Spain and therefore I'm great and you must love me. We have to think about, okay, you're from Spain and you've got great provenance in X, Y, and Z, but what else do you have? You know, you have to have more than just being from a certain country and, you know, being able to reach a consumer that way. I think Chinese consumers are, they must be aware that they're the best at e-commerce in the world. They have the best platforms in the world. But I also think that they are traveling more than ever. You know, when I'm in London, I always notice how many more Chinese students there are all the time. So they're traveling, living, studying, you know, all over the world, and they're getting the experience of all these different countries and products that they can't find at home. So as a brand, it becomes more competitive, but also as a brand, it becomes more advantageous, because if you're, if you're a student from Beijing and you've come to study fashion at the University of the Arts in King's Cross in London, and you're walking into Waitrose and you're finding British products, that you can't find at home. And then that brand starts to get wind of the fact that Chinese consumers are posting about it and talking about that brand, then you know that there's an appetite for it. And that gives you the opportunity to think, China should be part of my strategy. Let's explore going and selling in that market and, you know, selling on all these different channels and platforms. So there's, you know, there's pros and cons to everything. You always have to look at the bigger picture and then refine it down to how it works for your business, for your brand, and who your consumer is in that market. Because with these large populations in China and Asia, there will be a consumer for you. It's figuring out who.
Let's talk specifically about British brands. They've been very successful in China. I want to know why. Why are British brands so successful in China?
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about some of the really household names from the UK who have become super successful in China, businesses like Dyson, Charlotte Tilbury, Jellycat, Kids Toys, Burberry, you know, all of these brands, they all really have a very clear identity and DNA and product proposition. And either they've, you know, Dyson is super innovative, but the way that they kind of sold to consumers in China was slightly different than the way that they sold to consumers in the UK when they started. When they went to China, they really focused on the health of your home. And that messaging really resonated with the Chinese consumer. Burberry has obviously got hundreds of years of heritage as a really great fashion brand, and that was able to connect with Chinese consumers. And even when you look, you know, if you walk into a Burberry store in China, in Shanghai, say, or versus walking into the Burberry store in London, the way it's laid out is very different. You know, the way that the brand's been able to play on certain logos or heritages, that's different in China, but it has also kind of flowed out and impacted the way that it presents itself globally. And, you know, it's just various different ways of doing it and appealing to the consumer. I think, you know, a large part of why British brands have been successful in China is they play on that Britishness. There's a lot of history here. There's a lot of provenance. The UK-China relationship has historically been really strong, and consumers and students and people love coming here and holidaying here. But it's no longer enough to be just British and go to China and think that that's going to be a success. And you have to, you know, maybe take your provenance and then spin it and understand why that consumer in China or Asia want to buy it. And I think that's the same for most countries now as well. You have to really connect with your consumer.
So your career spans both China and Southeast Asia. What makes you optimistic about e-commerce in those other APAC markets? And frankly, did that influence your decision to join WPIC?
Am I optimistic about those markets? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So 10 years ago, I joined a business called Lazada, which was establishing e-commerce in Southeast Asia. So building the infrastructure to get the logistics going so that you could deliver to islands in the Philippines, bringing international brands to that market. I focused in on fashion and sport at that time. So doing a regional role, talking to big brands like Nike, Levi's, these sort of people, and helping them navigate Southeast Asia, understanding their customer. And then a couple of years into me being there, Lazada was acquired by Alibaba. So that already meant that the Chinese influence on e-commerce was able to really come to Southeast Asia. So the way that the Lazada app developed really took lots of learnings from the way that the Tmall and Tmall Global apps work, the way that they communicate to customers. So seeing that grow and, you know, consumers really reacting to that, and with those being such young markets, it's a no-brainer that those are the markets that are growing in the world. APAC is the absolute leader in e-commerce. So I'm definitely optimistic. There's also huge populations there as well, which is great. They're younger populations than the West. So all of those kind of things kind of add up. And with kind of, you know, the growing older economies in the West, businesses need to look to export and are able to gain the learnings to adapt to their international business. And all of those things are kind of why I wanted to join WPIC, why I still wanted to work with brands, why I still wanted to work within those categories that I love, like health and beauty and fashion, and still, you know, be able to work in an environment where we're constantly learning, you know, whether it's me and the WPIC team, whether it's the brands, whether it's the consumers, all of us are constantly learning through this process because it's changing so fast. The innovation, the habits, the trends, like it's changing all the time. And for me, I don't want to be sat stagnant doing the same thing for my whole life. I want to be, you know, learning and changing and being part of this exciting journey. So that was a big factor in wanting to join WPIC.
I don't know if it's, I mean, I think it's half learning and it's half just trying to keep up and half just trying to keep your head above water because everything changes so fast. But that's a big reason why we have the negotiation as well, is to try and help you, the listener, also be able to learn, keep up and keep your head above water. But Zarina Kanji, WPIC's newly appointed Managing Director for the UK and Europe, thank you once again for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Todd.
Okay, for everybody listening, don't forget, audio version only, that we have the videos over on the WPIC YouTube channel with shorts and other informational videos over there. And for those watching the YouTube, if you need your hands and eyes and ears for other things, well, not your ears. Your ears are going to be paying attention to the podcast, the audio only podcast available on all your favorite podcast platforms. But for myself and everybody at the negotiation and the WPIC team, and for Zarina Kanji, thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.